You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
All that I want in this life is the chance to do
Prospect Focused Podcast. I am your host, John Troopin, joined today by my co-hosts, Joe Doyle, staff writer for Lookout Landing, as well as Kate Prusser, managing editor of Lookout Landing. Kate, Joe, how are you guys doing today?
Hello.
Hello, hello, and welcome back.
Indeed. We are going to be wrapping up our top prospects list.
I can't believe it's over. I mean, I can, because it's been like 2 months. But
we've taken our time. We've luxuriated in a farm system far more full of people and talented players worth digging deep into than it has been in years past, which has felt pretty dang good.
Yeah, that it has really been fun to like be struggling to rank guys, and not because it's hard to figure out which of these, like, you know, C-level prospects should take a spot in the top 10, but like really having interesting discussions about ceilings and best case scenarios and some pretty exciting stuff.
It's been cool to have meaningful conversations for guys 11 through 20. I mean, that's a group of guys that might actually make an impact, which is fun.
Yeah, it's been pretty nice, pretty sort of a luxury that has not been there in years past. But this week we are going to leap right into the top five. Speaking of luxury, essentially, you know, where all of this work and all of these sort of exciting players come to a head with five guys who probably most Mariners fans know by name, at least, if not some level of detail, even if you're not a prospect sort of heavy enthusiast. No sort of George Felice on this list. It's a lot of folks that you will have heard their names. And let's just start with number five, number four, and number three. We've got at number five, right-handed pitcher George Kirby, the first-round pick in the 2019 draft. Number four, first baseman Evan White, first-round pick of the 2017 draft. And number three, right-handed pitcher Logan Gilbert, first-round pick in the 2018 draft. You know, sensing a theme here. There are lots of great sort of unexpected players who come out of, not necessarily nowhere, sometimes nowhere, but certainly come out of unexpected places to be good pros. But there's a reason the players taken at the top of the draft are commonly the most exciting, you know, and these three have really shown that in pro ball so far.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think, you know, all three of these guys were taken in that, you know, right in that range where you don't know what you're going to get. It's not going to
All in the teens.
Right? All in the teens, yeah. And all of them, you know, had question marks when they were selected. Gilbert with the drop in velo at the Cape. And, you know, Evan White didn't ever hit for power. And George Kirby, who just didn't, you know, didn't have too much of a shine. He was polished, but, you know, what's his ceiling? And I think
we small school. Knock on him was small school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But all of them have kind of, you know, come into their own. It's still early for Kirby, but all of them have kind of come into their own and proven to be pretty valuable prospects of their own right.
I have a question. Looking at Kirby, and looking at who is ostensibly in the same place Logan Gilbert was last year, although he actually did some pitching, so we have some kind of a track record for him.
To compensate for not getting to play baseball now.
Yeah, right. As opposed to Logan Gilbert, who didn't play at all due to some surgery, some sickness, and just general rest and how they like to slow play a college pitcher who's had a heavy workload. I was wondering, do you think that Logan Gilbert, who I'm pretty sure was lower or less well-regarded than Kirby at this time last year, like, that feels true to me, and it could be just me rewriting history. But I wonder how much Logan Gilbert and the way that he came out and dominated this year and moved through multiple levels and showed, like, not only that he was a good draft choice, but also the Mariners had a good development plan in place for him. I wonder if that has helped Kirby kind of be in higher standing in the prospect community, although with a similarly small track record?
That's a good question. So are you more or less suggesting that because the Mariners as an organization have proven to be successful in developing prospects as a whole, more specifically on the pitching side, that Kirby's small sample size at Everett has more legitimacy than it would have otherwise? Is that kind of what you're alluding to?
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking like kind of like Noel V. Marte. I think it's easy for them to, it's easy to look and see like, oh, he's on the same path Julio was on, and so that you can draw some comparisons there. It's easy to look at George Kirby and say, oh, that's the Logan Gilbert path. And these two are very similar pitchers in a lot of ways. Although Kirby, I think, came out of a smaller school and maybe doesn't have quite the stuff that Gilbert has, but also had more of an opportunity to show it. I just feel like he's getting more attention or recognition because it's easy to cast him in that mold and see that, okay, this pitcher who's very similar to him was successful in this system. It's very likely that this similar pitcher will also be successful.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something to that. And, you know, Kirby is, he's a high floor guy in and of his own right. So when you have the command that Kirby has, you know, there's a better chance that you're going to be able to get to the big league level and, you know, succeed at whatever ability you can. I think I'm really happy that the industry is giving Kirby the due that I think guys with higher floors deserve, because, you know, he was, what was he, the 17th pick, 18th pick, something like that?
I think it was 18, yeah.
Yeah, so I can guarantee there's not 17 or 16 guys from last year's draft class ahead of him in the top 100 rankings. I'd say he's, you know, there's probably 9 guys that are ahead of him. So it's nice to see someone that, while he showed that he can throw, you know, 96, 97 with a good curveball and a good changeup, it's just nice to see guys that are kind of labeled as high floor, high success rate pitchers getting their due on top 100 lists, because a lot of times those guys go, you know, without mention because they don't have the number one ceiling or the number two ceiling. So,
So going off of that sort of high floor, sort of uncertain ceiling type of designation, between Kirby and Gilbert, who I think it is a reasonable comparison to draw. Oh, these are two very similar types of pitchers. You know, obviously there's distinctions in what their better out pitches are and whatnot, but you know, their profiles are reasonably overlapping. Who do you think has the, we obviously have Gilbert ahead of Kirby. And part of that is he's 1 year ahead. He's one, you know, he's several levels higher and has had success the entire way up. Do you guys have a strong sense of which of either Kirby or Gilbert could actually sort of be that ace, or not ace in the sense of like, you know, Justin Verlander or, you know, necessarily like the best pitcher in baseball, but like what would commonly be referred to as a number two kind of starter, you know, sort of that top 15 kind of pitcher that throws 200 innings, you know, and consistently is well above average.
For me, I think Gilbert has the potential to be a true number one. I think he could be a top 15 pitcher. I think he could have that ace label. And a lot of that stems from the fact that he's got the stuff already, and that stuff is really starting to come into its own. He also has the deception that allows the ball to just blow up in the zone, and you know, he can spike a curveball, and the changeup is really good. He's throwing a slider a lot this spring, and all of the pitches that he throws are above average at this point. So for me, I think Gilbert has the edge. Now, that being said, we need to see more of George Kirby to make that designation, because everyone's talking about the fact, oh, you know, he's built how you want him. He's big and tall, and he's got clean mechanics, and he throws 97. But at you know, in college, Kirby wasn't throwing 97. He was 93 to 95. He threw a good changeup. It is exciting that he was throwing his curveball in Everett last year for first pitch strikes over and over and over. I mean, that's an advanced backwards pitch ability that can make you move up the system really, really quickly, like Gilbert did last year. So I don't think Kirby has the stuff that Gilbert has, but I do think, I should say, I'm really looking forward to seeing what he looks like over the course of like 80 innings, because that way we'll get a much better idea of how his stuff works in longer outings and against better competition.
Yeah, I think just currently I am so much more familiar with Gilbert's repertoire, just because I've been watching him for pretty intently this year and analyzing the pitches and looking at what he throws and looking at his sequencing and talking to him and learning about how he thinks as a pitcher. And I have a super high opinion of him because I think he's got a great combination of stuff, and I love his mentality on the mound. He is very nice. He's a very, very nice person. And on the mound, he is just a totally different person. He is absolutely a competitor. He wants to get guys out. He uses all his available weapons. I mean, he knows he's not like the hardest thrower out there. Like, he's not out there blistering triple digit fastballs. But what he has, which I think is in large part his intelligence and his knowledge of pitching and his work ethic, his study of his craft, his dedication to getting better, he brings all of that to bear in every pitch. So it's hard for me right now to put anyone ahead of him. I'm very high on Logan Gilbert. And obviously the brief taste that we got to see when he just mowed down the Angels was fantastic this spring, right? What an exciting outing that was. What a statement. But I'm really feeling robbed right now of the opportunity to do the same with George Kirby. Like, that was going to be my project this year, was to just really dive into Kirby, try to do kind of the same thing with tracking his development that I did with Gilbert last year. And that was going to be my research project this year, and I'm really, really sad not to be doing it right now. But absolutely. I feel like I can't put a, I need to know more about who George Kirby is as a person, as a pitcher, what his stuff looks like just objectively, and how he thinks about that. Because I think with pitching more than any other position on the field, it's so much mental. It's so much about, like, can you keep a cool head when you get into trouble? Can you not panic? Can you execute? Can you have that ice water veins moment, you know? And I think that that's something that I've seen Gilbert demonstrate. I've watched him get himself out of trouble. And I don't have that familiarity with Kirby yet.
Just kind of building off of your profile of Gilbert, the coaches that I've talked to about George Kirby and kind of as a segue, Brandon Williamson, from what I've been told, George Kirby is just stone cold. He's a blank slate, like totally non-emotional. There are no highs. There are no lows. He is just a guy on a mission, and he goes out there and he throws his pitches. He throws his innings, and he's a bulldog on the mound, but you try to get him to elicit any emotion off the mound or in interviews, and it's just not there.
He's our upstate New York Terminator.
Yeah, well, and I think Gilbert, there's a little bit of that as well, but I think Gilbert's got just a little bit more of a fiery side on the mound as far as, owning the situation than Kirby does. But that being said, like you said, we don't really know anything about Kirby. And the one kind of Brandon Williamson thing that I wanted to throw in there was apparently Williamson is just like the biggest class clown of the entire organization. He's a jokester. He's a prankster. He's always messing around with teammates and trying to get under their skin in a good way. So kind of a fun,
contrast,
differentiation there.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Cause I think that can work too. I think on the mound, you either have to take yourself like pretty deadly seriously or just really be able to make light of the situation and shake it off pitch to pitch. And, different things work for different guys. And I think that that's one exciting thing that we've seen this development staff do is the emphasis on be yourself. Like, there is no one pitcher. We're not going to try to impress like the Cardinals way on you. There is no one way to be as a player here. We want you to be yourself. And so getting to see these guys like develop their personalities and, as we're seeing kind of with Justice Sheffield and Justin Dunn, like, we're starting to see little flashes of who they are. And, Dunn's letting that swagger out a little. Like, he's kind of being himself on the mound. So I'm really excited to see this next crew do that. And I wouldn't be surprised if we were talking about Brandon Williamson. I mean, I'm expecting to be talking about Brandon Williamson in the same breath in which we're talking about Logan Gilbert and George Kirby next year, just to be clear.
I think that's it's an exciting group, and that's it's particularly important considering the Mariners have a few very exciting position players, two of whom obviously top this list, but they really will need pitching to come internally.
John, can we talk about that a little? Because I know that is something that when we look at the rebuild, I feel hopeful and optimistic about it. I do worry about a lack of depth in position players, but I feel like it's compensated for pretty well with pitching. I know that makes you nervous. Can you speak a little to that?
It does. I feel very similar to you. Like it's sort of the, you hold two thoughts in the head, right? I think that things are going pretty dang well for the rebuild. I think that the player dev stuff they're doing is fabulous. They've been showing a lot of promise with their development of pitchers in particular. And I think that there's a lot of young talent at the big league level or nearly approaching it that is very promising for the future. But because of the way that pitching prospects and pitchers in general are just naturally so much less, or so much more prone to injury, it really worries me when teams design their rebuilds around it. It's why I am very wary of the Tigers rebuild right now, which is full of incredibly talented players. You know, Matt Manning, Casey Mize. You know, I mean, these are what's his face?
Scooball? No, wait.
Yeah, it was Scooball, but the guy from Florida also, who they have.
Fado.
Yes, thank you, Alex Fado. Yeah, you know, like, these are legitimately talented pitchers who could make an exceptional rotation.
I mean, that is a crazy load of talent right there.
Yeah, exactly. But they are so thin on position players that all it takes is one or two of those guys getting hurt. Casey Mize has already had a lot of injuries and has injury concerns that make you think, like, is he going to be the top 10 talent that he has looked like when he's healthy? Or is he going to be a guy who struggles to be on the field consistently? And it's so much easier for a position player to, maybe they don't pan out as a star, but they're still able to play, you know, 140, 150 games a year and be, you know, more than the absence of a player. I like that the Mariners have young guys at pretty much every position now. I would love to see them really leaning into position players, you know, and especially having gone so heavy on pitching last draft, I really worry about if some of these guys don't pan out or some of these guys get hurt, you know, that they're going to have to put a ton of money into their rotation, which is, you know, fine. But again, it's like signing older pitchers isn't exactly all that much, you know, all that sort of confidence inspiring either. So I think the best organizations that you look at, the most successful organizations in the league right now, are ones that have developed position players stars. You know, the Cubs did that, you know, the Astros did that, the Dodgers also obviously done that. I mean, like, the Braves have done that. The Blue Jays, hopefully for them, are, you know, have got some very promising indications that they're doing that.
The White Sox.
Yeah, the Whites, exactly. You know, and
the Royals. Like, I mean, the Royals built their entire thing from the ground up.
Yeah, yeah, and so, no, I mean, you know, it's not like the Mets have been a failure exactly, but like, you know, well, like, it's very fun to rag on the Mets, and deserve it in many cases, but it's like they had one of the most incredible collections of pitching talent in decades. And all of them have had TJ. Several of them have burned out. Like, it, you know, and it's not like that means that those were failures of players, but it's just so much more likely that, unlikely that all that talent lines up at the same time. Whereas if you go heavy on position players, you're going to have more. It's a better bet that you'll have more bites at the apple when those guys are in their theoretical prime. Is my mindset for that. So I worry about the lack of depth there.
It just makes you wish Seattle found a way to lose a couple more games for Austin Martin. Just a couple more games. Just one there. But still, Zach Veen, baby.
Yeah, baby. So speaking of position players, who they will have at least in the lineup whenever the season starts, or whenever the next season starts, who knows? Evan White has been was somewhat unexciting when we when we drafted him. I think we've referenced this before, but when his name was called, there was like a little sort of collective sigh from you and me, Kate, and Ethan Novak, who was our prospects writer at the time, and the like excitement that rose up back again when Sam Carlson was drafted the next round. It was like, you know, that's what the draft is all about, is like, oh, this, you know, it's the you know, you have a car, or what's behind this door? It could be anything, even a car. You know, like, that's sort of the nature of prospects. Evan White, not that exciting. high floor, sort of a similar thing to Kirby and Gilbert. All three of these guys
plays. I think I was unenthused about Evan White in a lot of ways, but the thing that unenthused me the most was that he was a first baseman. Yeah. I was like, really?
No, that's fair.
Not even an outfielder.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I remember most from that 2017 draft is it feels like every player that I really wanted to fall, it was just like bang, 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 13, 14, 15, 16. And if I remember correctly, it was between Evan White and like Alex Fiedo or maybe David Peterson.
It was David Peterson. Everyone had mocked to us, and I was fully prepared to just throw my arm. You know I love a left-handed, but you know I love a tall lefty.
Well, and the pitching depth in the system was abysmal at the time. Certainly it was
absolutely. And I was just so sure that that was the direction. I had my welcome David Peterson banner all ready to unfurl. And yeah.
So, like you said earlier, Joe, like high floors are not always that exciting, but they are also like high floor players more often than not turn into big leaguers and high floor player, you know, high floor guys very easily because they're already healthy, because they're, you know, playing consistently, because they're going to keep getting opportunities. They sometimes figure out another gear, you know? So, and that's kind of what we've seen throughout the minors, at least from White, is okay, well, he's a glove first baseman, you know, and he'll have a good batting average. Okay, so he hits the ball really hard. Okay, well, now he's hitting some line drives. Is he going to strike out too much? Okay, well, now he's, you know, hitting the ball hard enough to get him out of Dickie Stevens and the team.
As a right-hander.
Yeah, exactly, as a righty. Like,
I think the industry is, and Kate will 100% back this, the industry is so quiet on Evan White. Like, people are not giving enough attention to what he did in Arkansas last year.
Not at all.
I mean, I've got it pulled up here. He hit 293, which is fantastic in and of itself. He slugged almost 500 at 488, 132 weighted runs created plus with 18 home runs, and that's insane right-handed at Dickie Stevens. And if we're just, I mean, it's easy to dream on a prospect, but those numbers over 155 games at the big league level, that's a 25 home run first baseman. Like, if he hits the pitches that he's supposed to hit, which is more difficult at the big league level, but over the course of 600 at bats, like, he did that in 400 at bats. If you get 650 at bats, you're going to hit 25 home runs. And I'm really, really high on Evan White, and I think he's going to be, he might not ever be a superstar, but I think he's going to be a really, really good first baseman for the Mariners for a long, long time.
Yeah, I think that's where it's come around to, is like, if he is just like an average or above average player, like, what, like, that is such a win, not just developmentally, but like after getting essentially goose eggs and goose eggs and goose eggs from development and from specifically first base.
Yeah. Like,
you know, the idea that, you know, it could not work out. He could struggle too much with big league pitching, and that would be disappointing. He has done everything thus far to make it seem like he should be all right. And
he's had some of the loudest exit velocities in this. I mean, he had the hardest hit ball at the Futures game last year.
Yeah.
In playing with, you know, the top prospects in the game and off of a power pitcher. I think it was Mackenzie Gore that he hit that rocket off of, which got caught because, unfortunately, sometimes baseball is mean. But if it had dropped, if that had been like a laser double, I think that Evan White would be getting a lot more attention than he was. Like, that one thing, if that had broken right for him, would, which honestly, I don't think Evan White cares about being a superstar. He's super humble. I think he's the kind of guy that, like, doesn't even want that, really. He just wants to go out and do the best he can and kind of be quietly excellent. I see, like, a almost like an Edgar-like thing where he could be overshadowed by some of his teammates, but when we look back at his career, we like, oh, wow, Evan White was really good.
That's certainly the hope. I think the very nice thing about this group is it's not just like, hey, this person could be a central, you know, piece if things keep working. It's like, this is what it's supposed to be. And especially with White and Gilbert, most likely with Kirby because of his profile, but especially with White and Gilbert, like, they're gonna play for the Mariners probably this year, or, you know, whenever the next season of Mariners of baseball happens. Like, they're gonna be on the Seattle Mariners in the big leagues. You're going to watch them, and you're gonna see Evan White play for the Mariners for a very long time. Like, you know, so
they signed him to a contract. Like, whether he's good or not, we're gonna see.
Like, yeah,
we're gonna see him. Yeah, it's not, will this guy be a major leaguer? It's when and for how long.
Exactly.
But there's one more thing I want to say about Evan White that I think gets missed, because he is quiet. He doesn't have a huge social media presence. He is, from all outside appearances, very boring. He is actually sneakily very funny, and he's very funny at, like, giving Kyle Lewis shit pretty regularly. I think that's a particularly interesting pairing. But if you look at that group that was in Arkansas, Dunn, Sheffield, White, Lewis, Zamorelli, Jordan Cowan, all those guys, Warren, all those guys just really loved each other, and they are a core. And, like, not all those guys are going to be big leaguers. Like, we have questions about our Warren's ability to stay healthy as control. Zamorelli is looking like he might be a AAA guy. But they're all a group that believes that they are the next coming of the Mariners. They're very tight. They hang out together all the time. Oh, Fraley's in that group, too. They were all together in Arizona. They hung out for a long... Some of them are still there together in quarantine. And really, the heart of that all is Evan White. Because he is more advanced. Because he's been in the system longer. Because he got married and he has a house. And they all hang out at his house. Like, he's just a little bit ahead of the curve. And he, I think, is such a centering force that... He is the rock of that. You know, he might not be the name that gets the most attention. He might not be the furthest along, like Sheffield or Dunn, who've already been in the majors. But he is, I think, very much like the central piece of that. He's the one who was drafted as a Mariner. He carries a lot of, like, the organizational values. And I think that if you asked any of those guys, they would all say that Evan White is the center of that group.
Well, I mean, you look at how everyone reacted to Evan getting his extension.
Yes.
Big leaguers and minor leaguers, when people get paid, when people get signed, when people make their money, how often do you see, like, a sweeping campaign on
every
social media
single,
of
every single
person congratulated Evan? There was nobody that was left out. So
including
that really speaks to
from
the
opposing teams, like players he has played with, like Colin Thoreau, who is with the A's, who's friendly with some of the guys in our organization, thrilled for him.
Yeah, it seems like Evan is just he's a really easy guy to get along with, and he definitely seems like he represents an anchor in a clubhouse. One other thing that I wanted to add on Evan, and this is a drum that I've been beating for the better part of a decade, the Mariners haven't been able to sign or develop or, you know, acquire any first baseman that can accrue one war, like 1.0 war. Like, that's like 18 people a year get one war, and it's been like 12 years since the Mariners have done it. Since, like,
I believe
Olerud.
Austin Nola did it last year.
Yeah, but he's a catcher, and also Encarnacion did it too. But he was only here for like two months, and so there are those two little outliers. I
I don't think it's too much to ask for one WAR from your first baseman back-to-back years.
Well, right? So that's why I went back and I looked at some profiles over the last like 7 or 8 years that might be akin to what Evan White's production might look like, and two of them really stood out. In 2013, Eric Hosmer with the Royals hit 302, 353, 448. He stole 11 bags and he hit 17 home runs while playing an above average first base. That's 3.1 WAR. Now his defense has completely fallen off a cliff and so is his bat, but that's 3.1 WAR from Hosmer. I think 11 stolen bases and 17 home runs, not a 301 average, but I think those are two numbers that I could definitely see Evan White posting. And then the other one, and you have to keep in mind, if he is playing a plus-plus defense at first base, that's going to give him major points, yeah, at least in the fan graphs way of thinking. And then the other one here, if I can pull it up, was one I didn't expect. It was Carlos Santana from 2015. I know he was a catcher for a lot of his career, but they have him labeled as a first baseman in 2015 with the Indians. He hit 231, 357, 395, so not quite as good. 11 stolen bases and 19 home runs with extraordinary walk and strikeout rates. But that was 2.1 WAR. So, and he was never an extraordinarily gifted defensive first baseman either. So I think that kind of lays the groundwork for what Evan is capable of with his athleticism on the bases, his glove at first base, and, you know, that 17 to 22 home run power. I hope that we're looking in 2022 to 2026 as a guy that is, you know, 2.5 to 3.5 WAR just every single year, churning it out and just, like I said earlier, just being an anchor in the clubhouse, someone you can rely on.
Kind of like a Marco Gonzalez of the offense in a way.
The one thing that I'm worried about with him is, because we were talking about, like, how many plate appearances he would get. The one red flag with him for me is the hamstrings, the injuries, the lower body injuries.
Definitely.
Because that has been, and I feel like it wouldn't be responsible to not mention that has been a concern.
Yeah, and that's been, like, most of his career, unfortunately. Yeah. Like, he's spending this off time
working on that lower half, doing whatever it takes to build up some bananas. Flexibility there.
Yeah, it's a question that none of us ever have to answer. If you can do the splits, do you do the splits?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, let's move on to our big two up at the top. We've got number two outfielder Julio Rodriguez and number one outfielder Jared Kelnick. So we obviously, I don't think there's anywhere that has a different two players at the top of any Mariners list they would make. Both these guys, I think, were top 20 prospects universally around pretty much every major list that I saw. And a few lists, they were both top 10 prospects even. We talked about this a fair bit. How did we end up with Jared slightly ahead of Julio? Kate, what made the difference there for you?
The difference is that while I think Julio has a higher ceiling, Jared had more opportunities to show what he did this year, mostly because he didn't have a broken hand.
Yeah.
So he was able to progress pretty quickly through levels and I was able to watch him absolutely outclass the competition at West Virginia in the South Atlantic League. Uh-huh. Watched him struggle with being frustrated that he wasn't getting pitches to hit. Watched him kind of learn to back off and not swing because he wasn't, and just take walk after walk after walk. Watched him go to Modesto. Watched him succeed there initially and then have a little bit of injury trouble and then have real trouble hitting breaking balls, like quality breaking stuff. watched him get frustrated, watched him get better, watched him go to double A, watched him cope with higher velocities, watched him cope with much better pitchers, older pitchers. Like, there were times where he was being pitched to by a guy who was literally a decade older than him. So just from watching that and watching him struggle, succeed, develop, I had to put him higher. I saw a lot of the same things from Julio. I saw him make adjustments, especially at Modesto. I thought that was really impressive when, again, being pitched to by guys who are like almost a decade older than him. But it was, well, maybe more like 5 years at Modesto. Anyway, it was a similar path and it was similarly exciting, but unfortunately it was attenuated because of the injury. So gotta give it to Jared for this.
Fair enough. Joe?
I had Jared above Julio as well. And my reasoning is, like I said with Kirby, I really appreciate a high floor. And I think Jared, like Kate said, is a little bit ahead of Julio in the fact that he has a tried and true polished bat. He hits for some power. But also, for me, like, real value on the baseball field in modern baseball especially is just being able to do everything, being able to approach that five-tool moniker. And Jared does that. I mean, he plays a good center field. He's got a good arm. He can steal a base. He can hit a homer. And to me, that's the sort of thing that's invaluable, because when you're coming up and you slump, you have to find other ways to contribute. And I think that's something that Jared is not going to struggle with. And I think that's something that Julio might have to adjust to a little bit more. The bat's always going to play, but how is his speed going to age in right field? He's got a great arm, but how is his speed and enthusiasm going to age on the base paths? So, yeah, I still think they're going to be like an excellent, you know, 2-3 in the batting order. But for me, I'm a bigger fan of someone that can, you know, drop our jaws anywhere, anytime, at any moment.
I have been pleasantly surprised by Jared's defense. And I have to say, like, that is one thing that should probably be considered, as not just that he has kind of the build to be speedier on the base paths, but his defense. Because mostly when I saw him coming up as a prospect or as a drafty, in showcase events, he was playing right field a lot of times because there was a more defensively plus center fielder to play in front of him. So I sort of had this in my mind that he was eventually going to be a right fielder, even if, you know, they all start in center field. But he really has shown an ability to stick there, and he dealt with that Arizona sky really well, I thought, both in last year's spring training and this year's, in the kind of brief opportunities we get to see him. He's really smart at running routes. He just has that instinct that I think you can't always teach for what the most efficient way is to get to the ball. And I think the biggest, most, I expected a lot out of Jared with his bat because that swing is so perfected. I mean, it's just the same swing all the time. He has his approach. He does not stray from his approach. So I expected a lot there. I think the biggest, most pleasant surprise for me in watching him this year was really, it was his ability to adjust to whatever and overcome adversity. But the biggest thing, I think, next to that was just being so pleasantly surprised at his defense.
He's smooth, too. I mean, we've watched enough center fielders over the years, you know, look a little frantic underneath the ball, to where, you know, you're just kind of sitting there like, oh, I hope this ends up in his mitt. Even though he's, like, not mobile and the ball is just coming straight down, can of corn, like in Toronto when Saunders got hit in the forehead.
Oh,
like, you
man.
Know, I don't get that with Jared. He just glides to it and he makes it look effortless. And
yeah,
that's,
he
that's
does
just
not do the Mitch Haniger thing where it's,
oh,
like, you
God.
Are so
oh, that's
athletic,
a great one.
And yet you, like, unless you are moving at your, like, expected exact rate, like, things look so out of whack.
That's
like,
a
that
great one.
Is,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or,
example.
Or you know, it's tough to say.
Ackley?
Everyone, Ackley. But even like, even Malik Smith to a lesser degree. And I think that was nerves. Mm-hmm. He just doesn't look comfortable under the ball. And Jared in Arizona, just he just glides to it and gets there at a steady pace. And yeah, I that's something that I really appreciate when they make it look easy and effortless. And Jared does that.
It is interesting for such a high energy guy, such an intense, I mean, Jared is so intense. And it's so interesting to see how that doesn't seem to translate to his style of play. I mean, he still plays with intent, don't get me wrong, but like he really seems to be able to just control that intensity and bring the same approach to, you know, it doesn't matter what's happened the pitch before. I've definitely seen him get frustrated at the plate. He gets frustrated with himself, but he is mostly able to, he knows what his approach should be and he knows that he should be sticking to it. And that's the biggest thing that I see him learning, is he's learning how to manage that intensity. And that's not really a problem in the field. He just is, like you said, just cool as a cucumber out there all the time. Although, again, still playing with intensity. So it's a really fun balance.
When do you guys think it would be reasonable to expect both of these guys in Seattle at the same time?
For me, I don't think there's any way. Obviously, there's no way you see it this year.
Right.
I think the work stoppage obviously creates a ton of doubt for Julio making it to the big leagues in 2021.
Do we know how? I know the like deal that the union has is advancing a year of service time for anyone who has big league time. Does this count as a minor league like year? Like, does this count as a year towards the Rule 5 draft? Like, how does do? So I don't mean to put you guys on the spot. I was thinking about this earlier and was wondering if this had an impact on that.
I'm just thinking out loud. I haven't heard anything, but if they are shortening the draft to 5 players, I don't think there's any way for a competitive balance that you could advance minor leaguers another year of service. There'd be such an enormous gap in between players that are eligible for the Rule 5. The Rule 5 draft would be inconsequential 1 year. I don't know. That might not be the end of the world, but I would think that they do not get that luxury. Because also, they're not a member of the MLBPA. So.
Right, and there's not really, yeah. They wouldn't they would very easily be something they could say, oh, well, no. We'll keep them away from us for another year.
But they have rights too, so someone's got to be bargaining, or it's got to be in the contract language. That's a great question.
Yeah. Anyways, sorry. So not this year. When do you think would be a reasonable time in maybe two years? Do we think like 2022?
Yeah, I think at the latest.
Yeah.
I'm still on the blind hope that they get in a few games this year and maybe we get a little bit of double J action in late 2021, but I recognize that is a sweet, sweet fantasy, baby.
I do wonder a lot about like what sort of like priority a team might have. This actually I wondered with Kirby as well, and I guess Logan Gilbert, although it's pretty hard to imagine he wouldn't be up in Seattle at some point this year anyway. But like, you are a team, the Mariners have been reasonably aggressive and have said they're not, you know, they are going to promote guys when they're ready and when they meet their sort of organizational goals, and thus far they've been reasonably aggressive with promoting guys, whether that, you know, has service time implications or not. You know, whether this all has an impact on if Seattle is going to be sort of pushing guys like Kelnick and Kirby and Julio up through the ranks more quickly, less quickly, like how this, you know, obviously it's really hard to see how they would be impacted developmentally, but like do you think that there's an incentive to sort of slow that promotion cycle down?
So I think it's interesting because we don't even know if there's going to be minor league baseball at all this year. And right. I don't think there's going to be,
yeah,
because there's not enough fields. So I don't think minor leaguers are even going to play. That being said, slowing it down, one thing that the Mariners have the luxury of is like all of their best assets are currently not getting service time. You know, so we're not worried about people aging out of their contracts or anything like that. All of the players in Seattle are coming up, so they can be a little bit more patient in that respect. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would definitely not accelerate the pedal at all. I'd wait until these guys are ready. There's no rush. You know, take your time. Wait until they're ready.
I think that the way that the organization does it is irrespective of anything else, the number one thing that determines where guys play is how they're hitting those developmental goals. So I don't think things like service time, and as Joe pointed out, we're kind of in the luxury where, like, really the service time thing is not an issue for anyone other than Evan White, maybe, who wasn't,
but he didn't play.
So didn't
I don't think he gets it.
No, right? I don't. No, none of the top assets, none of the guys who we're talking about on this list, all they'll get is like a little more age, which is maybe not great.
Yeah, but you again, would see like Sheffield and Dunn and Kyle Lewis.
Yeah, so
definitely
that part,
Fraley.
Yeah, Crawford and
that part is a little rough because it, I feel like, maybe widens the gap between those guys who are already at the major league level and the ones who haven't been there yet.
Uh-huh.
The suspension of the season will hurt every team. Like, there's no way it's not going to hurt any team. Maybe it doesn't hurt the, I don't know, Orioles, just because how do you kill something that's already dead?
Oh, jeez.
That's, you know, not wrong.
Well, I mean,
no, absolutely.
I can't argue with that.
No, they're, when you have not a lot, like, making everybody wait on a year, it honestly might be somewhat beneficial for them. They get another, some more downtime to, like, craft an organizational strategy and do a lot of things that I think the Mariners did pretty quickly. So,
well, they don't have to face Gleyber 60 times this year.
Yeah.
That God. Is, maybe, I imagine that the off-season meetings, the Zoom meetings, it's just a big chart of Gleyber Torres' face while they try to figure out, maybe they all throw, like, virtual darts at it or something, I don't know. But yeah, so I think that the development is still going to dictate everything that happens, regardless of what is going on in the broader baseball world. So I'm really glad that they have a strongly articulated development philosophy, clearly articulated goals for each guy. And, you know, it seems like there is kind of a plan. It seems like there's kind of a plan, but they're not really allowed, I think, to give guys like direct instructions. So it feels so weird. Like, everybody's just kind of like, well, you're on your own now, and we'll see see you when you see you. Hope you've got a batting cage in the backyard, which has led to like some of the Dominican guys rigging up some pretty ingenious solutions to that. Like, Jonathan Clase tied a tire to a tree and has been using that as like a batting cage. So it's been exciting to see like a lot of guys just getting their work in, but I'm like, how is this? What are the developmental goals here? Like, what is the oversight? What is their distance learning looking like right now?
Yep.
So that is probably my bigger concern, other than anything like with service time or anything, is like, how do we, after an extended hiatus, how are we maximizing guys' time during this downtime, and how are we getting them all back so that they can accelerate their progress once there's baseball again? But that's above my pay grade to figure out.
Speaking of pay grades, obviously Julio, even in, you know, even if things were absolutely normal and baseball is being played, He wouldn't be a big leaguer, you know, at the outset of this year. I think we would probably all agree, you know, Kate, you outlined nicely that Kelnick, despite being sort of quite a talented player and showing a lot of improvement, he did struggle when he first came up to Double A with good curveballs and good off speed. But that there was a lot of development that happened there, and you could argue based on his end numbers, this guy could be a big leaguer, especially considering there's not a ton of overwhelming talent with Mitch Haniger being hurt. So I would put it to you guys, would you guys sign Jared Kelnick to a Evan White style deal at the start of whenever baseball comes back here? And what do you think a deal like that should look like if the Mariners and Kelnick are both able to get on board for that?
I famously do not understand money or contracts, so I'm going to skip that part of the question. But I will say, because my idea is just to like pull an old timey like steam engine up in Wisconsin and start shoveling money onto his front
lawn. Absolutely. I mean, that is
like, and you know, then just the, when Jared yeah. says enough, that's good, then you drive the steam engine.
Oh, good away. Luck with that. Good luck with the stopping point.
Yeah, I mean, keep shoveling yeah. until it's empty. I don't care. Like, give him what he wants.
I have good. There's reason to believe Jared would not sign a contract right now, just because of the way that he's built and the way that his mind works. Yeah. That being said, I don't know if I would do that. I mean, you got to look at the Luis Robert deal from Chicago, right? So what, he got 6 years, 88 mil, something like that?
With a couple option years, I think, two options.
So, so it looks like 6 years, 50 mil with two club options at 20 million each. So actually, looking at that, I would probably do that. 1.5 this year, and then 3.5, 6, 10, 12.5, and 15. I think I would do that. But you look at some of the other deals, like Ronald Acuna, where the last 2 years of his ARB are like outlandishly high, like 22 and 25. I think that's a risk that isn't necessary right now. But unfortunately, I think that's what it would take to get someone like Jared to sign on. So, I mean, if you get a player-friendly and club-friendly deal, like 6 years, 50 mil for Jared, I would do that. Especially if the two club options are only 20 million.
Yeah. It's an interesting situation, especially because, you know, Kelnick was that first round pick. He got first round money. So, like, you know, it's not as though he's in a position of need necessarily in the way that, you know, some prospects and families unfortunately don't have sort of that initial baseline, in addition to obviously Kelnick, I think, having a reasonably stable
right family, he's not signing to situation. Take care of his family back in right. the Dominican or anything, which is unfortunately I think an aspect of some of these other, you know, they take the guaranteed money because that is something that isn't,
it's life necessity. You know, it's life-changing. Yeah. You don't have to worry about money again if you manage it well, which is the point of all of this, but it, you know, well, yeah,
right, but it's very different when your family has had to worry about money versus
exactly
one thing I wanted to say, sorry, John, did I interrupt you?
No, you did not.
There's one aspect that I think you can play on with Jared that's a little bit different, and partially it's that, like, his family is financially comfortable. He is financially comfortable. He sees himself and fully believes that he will be a big leaguer and will continue to get paid for a long time. So he's definitely willing to bet on himself, but also I think that there is an aspect that's beyond money with Jared, and that is, I think he knows or is acutely aware of the general perception of the Mariners, that they are a joke. That they are, you know, sort of a cursed franchise, that they have had this string of bad luck, that they've never won. And I think that there's a real appeal with to a guy like him to be the one who lifts this franchise out of the trash heap, like, who is the face of... I think that that appeals to him on a different level, and it's not really a monetary thing. It's like, if he feels like he could kind of single-handedly help spur the rise of the Mariners to prominence, I think that that's a really appealing challenge for a guy who loves challenges. And I know it's something that he and Julio have talked about, how they want to be the ones who bring a championship to Seattle. And I think everybody says that, but those two specifically mean it.
Well, and I think it's something they've very intentionally, as an organization, tried to cultivate, right? Like that sort of bonding mentality that you talked about, you know, with the, you know, that Arkansas group. Like that's it is very much in service of the, you know, the organization that the Mariners have kept a lot of that group together and sort of set, you know, tried to build that up of like, you have to work now because you're going to be the ones, you have to, you know, keep working on this, and you have to, you know, hold each other accountable because you guys are going to be the ones, which I think is it's a fascinating kind of situation, honestly, of like, it's smart by the organization, and it's also like a unifying experience that I know, you know, would be meaningful, but also like, that's us, a crazy amount of pressure, right? You know, I mean, like, even more so than just the average, like, any big leaguer, any professional athlete has a ton of pressure on them. Like, that's a really significant level of expectations.
Hello, here is this franchise that has been the laughingstock of baseball for the last four decades. It's up to you guys to turn it around for us. All right, we'll check back in a year. Have fun.
Don't show Jared that John Bois SB Nation video. Don't show that to him.
Oh, he's seen it. I mean, somehow that has filtered across his. He sees those comments and all the doubting. I mean, he sees it. Julio sees it. They're aware of it. Like, every guy in the organization is aware of it. Yeah. And every guy wants to be the one who helps to change it, I think.
We will at some point get a, like, Mariners read mean tweets video, and it'll be like Julio like chuckling, Logan Gilbert and Evan White just kind of like very stoically reading it, like
just total
Kyle Lewis face. Like kind of twitching his eye but then like putting on a smile, and Jared like reading it deadpan and then just staring at the camera like he's
like just, he wants like, to punch
like,
it
like, oh, like he is gonna find who you know Mike J 99845, like he will he is going to
Jared
drop
is Liam
some,
Neeson.
Yeah,
I will find you. Yeah, and I will kill you.
He's gonna sign an extension and immediately put it towards doxing the person and just like sending a strike, swatting their home or something.
Well, let me ask. Let me kind of flip the switch, and we talked about Jared signing an extension, but would you sign Julio to an extension?
I mean, I would do it in a year. 100%. And maybe that's like too late, but you know, I think that the idea on the extension obviously is if you're signing someone to a minor league deal, you're starting that not the service clock but the option clock, and you have to put them on the 40 man, and just from a pure like logistical standpoint, it's a little bit inconvenient to do that on someone who's going to start in Modesto,
right?
But like, if that's, you know, if that's going to be something he wants to do, like, and that will give him the confidence and the comfort to be like, great, like, this is my path, like, this is what I'm doing. Like, I think that peace of mind makes a big difference. It's one of the things that's sort of challenging about those extensions is, like, you are signing guys to what could very easily, if things go well for them, be way under market. You know, way undervaluing themselves later on. Like you mentioned, Joe, like Ronald Acuna, like he is very likely going to be heavily underpaid relative to how much he's producing when he's being paid $22 million, right? Like, you know, like Mike Trout was underpaid when he signed his extension, even though it was, you know, whatever, 140 million. Yeah, I mean, it's the like the economics of MLB that are way out of whack with, you know, reality, because that, you know, these guys are so good and the relative productivity. But in a very literal sense, like, if a guy wants to sign a contract and it's, you know, the people advising him have their best interests at heart, that's, I think, a positive for everyone, right? Like that, you know, so something that would have these two locked in Seattle at a reasonable rate for everyone involved, like that, you that would be such an exciting thing, I think, for Seattle, of like, these are the guys, they're not going anywhere, they chose to be here, like, we're gonna make it work with them. That's something that we haven't had in a very long time.
Right. Yeah. I mean, as long as nobody's being exploited.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
If the agent is a good agent, a smart agent,
yeah,
and nobody's getting exploited, I have no problem with it. You know, the player can make the decision that they want to make.
Right.
I got one more little fun poll for you guys.
Hit it.
So let's say Jared plays the next, you know, 6 to 8 years here. Matt Kemp currently owns the most ejections since 2008. So in the last 10 years, Matt Kemp has been ejected 14 times. Over under, Jared, 14 ejections in his first decade in the bigs.
I will say over. I think that I would say over. Here's what I'll say. I think robot umpires come in some point in his career, whether that spikes it or
oh, yeah, Jared does not care.
I don't know whether that spikes it or whether that sort of undercuts it. Like whether it puts the umpire further away, you know, I think that he may be even more irate, you know, without sort of the tangible object that he can take out his fury on. So I'll take the over.
I'll take the under, just because I think that Jared, I don't know if this might exacerbate as he gets older, but I think Jared knows that he's not supposed to be a dirtbag. Like, he has strong dirtbag tendencies, and I mean dirtbag in like a loving way, just to be clear. Like when he said that he knew he was going to hit that home run in spring training, and he was like, I mean this in the most humble way possible. And I was like, I'm just stating facts. Yeah. You can say the words.
Jared Kelenic has big facts, don't care about your feelings. Yeah. Like, and the facts are, I'm better than you. And I'm right and you're wrong.
And I'm right. Like, yeah, you can say, I mean this in the most humble way possible. That doesn't actually make the words that come out of your mouth.
No,
which are,
the
and
no
then
offense,
I called my
defense.
Shot like Gary, like Ruth. Like, that doesn't, that doesn't take away from what you just said. Like, you can't just wish things into existence by saying them. But it did show me that he knows he's not supposed to be a cocky bastard. But he can't help it. Like, he is who he is. So I think that Jared has, like, a level of societal awareness where he's like, oh, I shouldn't be a dick and get myself ejected by arguing. I think that better angels of his nature might swoop in and kind of save him from himself, which is, again, it's a really interesting, like, I don't think I would like Jared Kelenic as a person. I don't know that we'd be friends necessarily, but I think I'd respect him, and I think I'd want to work on group projects with him, because we'd get A's, and if we didn't get an A, he'd go to the teacher and he'd make sure we got an A. And like, not only would we get an A, but we would crush everyone else. Like, Jared Kelenic at a science fair, like, forget about it. He will not lose. He refuses to lose.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it's not like my personality style, but I respect it. So I think that he would be able to, like, even though he would really want to, I think that he is self-aware enough to know when he has to rein himself in the most humble way possible.
Yeah. I think there's something too also coming up in the guys who come up in the age where everything is on camera, like there is so, you know, it is impossible to sort of get away with something, you know, in that sense of like, you're just going to be a little bit more hyper aware of your image. And maybe, you know, maybe that doesn't matter as
well.
Much,
and he's invited, like, it too. He's got his YouTube channel. He's put himself on camera. He's built this, you know, persona to some extent.
He's also 20.
Exactly. Yeah. I think it's likely that that cools with age and ABs.
Yeah. I mean, he's 20, but I'm also wholeheartedly taking the over.
All right. Well, thank you both for talking through 30 prospects and many more all the way through our top 50 list. It has been very fun. It has been, as Kate said, like a few months and like just very surreal since when we started this. We were very excited to see. I think Kate was literally in, you know, at spring training at one point. I think we recorded before you went down at some point. Then
came right back up.
Yep.
A very abbreviated trip this year.
Yeah, it was rough. But obviously we're gonna continue coming up with stuff for you guys here. Last week we talked to Carlos Collazo of Baseball America. We're gonna have some more interviews there for you guys. We're gonna try and talk to some players, talk to some coaches, talk to experts, you know, etc. And we're going to keep things going, keep sort of that spark of baseball energy and enthusiasm alive as we wait for baseball itself to spark back up and give us some more day-to-day things to talk about. Any final thoughts from you guys on the top prospect list as we've reached the summit?
Obviously it was really exciting to do this and not feel like I was fudging things this year. Mm-hmm. Like, definitely I have, and I feel like it has made me better in that I can accept criticisms about players better, because I don't feel like I need to be so defensive of every single player on the list.
Absolutely.
So it has definitely led to me being a more balanced analyst, where I can see guys' weaknesses because there are so many other strengths to see. So that's been exciting. If you're listening to this, you don't need to be sold on the gospel of prospects. Maybe you just tuned in just because, you know, it's Jared and Julio and those are two guys, you know. But they're really, I know a lot of people don't want to get into prospects because so many of them don't pan out and it's so much to learn and whatever, but it really is such a fun way to learn how to understand a lot of the underpinnings of baseball. If you listened to this and liked it, please get a friend to get involved. Like, someone you know who likes baseball but maybe isn't so into prospects. Like, really, I guess I'm asking for you to proselytize prospects.
Prospectalitize.
Because it is, I think, something that we as Mariners fans have been turned off of for a while, because there was so much promise and then futility and failure and loss and sadness in the earlier part of this decade. And then, you know, we just didn't really have a farm system as we tried to build a competitor later in the decade. And it hasn't been a great time to check in, but now I think it really is. And, you know, so I would challenge everyone who has listened, thank you for listening through all of this, to like try to get one of your friends who isn't that into prospects. That I think would be, it would just make me so happy. So you want to make me happy, don't you? We work so hard.
If one of your friends is one of those guys that loved Nirvana before Nirvana was Nirvana, they'll love prospects.
Yeah, so, if you have like a hipster friend who likes to be on the forefront of everything, mm-hmm. that pick that friend and recruit them into
but
our
don't
land
be
of
that way about it. That yeah. sucks also. Let yeah. them be that way, but don't
yeah, but
be
not
that
you.
Way yourself.
Yeah, that is
it's an important distinction, because yeah. that doesn't make other people want to listen to the thing that you're
no.
into.
No.
My goodness. Nobody wants to hear about how you saw so-and-so coming.
Liking and knowing prospects does not make you a bigger baseball fan
exactly.
than anyone else.
No.
It just means you like different parts of the sport. Yeah.
It is, and there's just more baseball opportunities that you get to expose yourself to, which is, I think, what... I know it was a big appeal to me about it. I know Kate, especially in sort of some of the leaner times, that was big for us. And Joe, I imagine you came by it in a similar way of wanting just more access and more things to sort
it's of like
get
you can play Road
in.
To the Show, but with like humans.
It's exactly
that is,
like that.
It is uncannily like that. All right, y'all. Thank you so much for listening, for subscribing, for downloading, for telling folks. And we will talk to you guys next week.